Good evening. It's Monday night, June 21st, 2020. This is Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. It's Monday, June 21st, 2020. Ahead tonight, Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth explores further what last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling regarding LGBTQ rights means to people here. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, Georgia was one of the first states to reopen. But unlike Texas and Florida, the state is not seeing a surge in virus cases reported. Some scientists believe testing problems might be hiding the true story. That and the rest of the news on Morning Edition tomorrow from 5 to 9 on 91.3 KUAF. There are now more than 5,000 active cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas, and the cumulative total of cases is now past the 16,000 mark. At today's press briefing in Little Rock, Governor Asa Hutchinson announced there are 522 new cases that were discovered in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period, with 124 of those in Washington County and 78 in Benton County, again, the counties with the two highest new case totals. The governor says the state has conducted just more than 120,000 tests this month, reaching a goal that was set for the month a little bit more than a week before the end of June. The governor is also sharing some new statistics regarding hospital capacity. He says the state's hospitals have more than 28% of beds available and more than 22% of ICU beds available. And that's considering all patients hospitalized statewide for COVID-19 or any other reason. And the governor says more than 65% of the state's ventilators are still available. Dr. Nate Smith, Arkansas Secretary of Health, says he finds these numbers encouraging.
We're going to continue to watch our hospital capacity, beds, ICU beds, ventilators, staffing, PPE, all these other things. Beds, we do have some ability to expand. We had planned for that back in March and April. We haven't had to implement those plans yet, but if we do, we have a way of expanding beds. We can even expand ICU beds. There are beds that can be, with proper staffing and equipment, be converted to ICU beds or ICU-like beds. The hardest thing to address if you don't have it is ventilators. And so it's encouraging that we do have almost two-thirds of our ventilator capacity is available.
And Dr. Smith says there are still more ventilators on order. The hospital numbers come after a meeting today between hospital administrators and state officials that took place in Little Rock. Administrators from hospitals in central Arkansas say only about 5% of their beds are occupied by COVID-19 patients. Dr. Cam Patterson with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences says the story is different for his colleagues in Northwest Arkansas, that there are adequate resources at the hospitals, but some are getting close to being capacity strained. And he says hospitals across the state are prepared to help.
We have been in close contact with the CEOs of those facilities to talk about both short-term and long-term plans for assisting in providing care for COVID-19 patients. If those facilities get to the point where they're not able to meet the demands of the hospitalized COVID-19 patients in their geographic region. And in the short term, the capacity assistance that we can provide will be accepting transfers from those facilities. Over the long term, we've had discussions with those facilities about moving healthcare providers to those areas, to those hospitals, so that if Washington Regional and Mercy Hospital need to expand the number of beds that are capable of handling COVID-19 patients in their facilities, that they can tap into UAMS human resources to ensure that that happens.
And Dr. Patterson says he's been asked if Arkansas would reinstitute a pause in elective surgery if COVID-19 numbers continue to rise. While Dr. Patterson says he does not speak for the Arkansas Department of Health, he says the state's hospitals are in a different place now than they were in March. He says then there were safety issues that have been addressed in the months since.
What's different now compared to when that was done is we now have much better testing. We now have much better personal protective equipment. We have better means of segregating patients who are getting elective procedures from patients who are COVID-19 infected. So I certainly don't want to speak for the Department of Health, but if there is continued increases in the number of COVID-19 patients requiring hospitalization, the reason for stopping elective procedures won't be for safety issues. I think we have the safety issues addressed. So as long as we can maintain the capacity to manage taking care of COVID-19 hospitalized patients, we don't have a safety need to stop doing elective procedures at the same time.
The complete press briefing can be viewed at Governor Asa Hutchinson's YouTube channel. Tomorrow's press briefing will be conducted in Mountain Home. We'll carry that session scheduled for 1:30 live on 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. In a historic ruling this past week, the United States Supreme Court voted in favor of extending protections to lesbian, gay, and transgender employees under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth reports how the judgment has an impact on LGBTQ people in Northwest Arkansas.
Last Monday, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects gay, lesbian, and transgender employees from discrimination based on sex. Last year, the Arkansas Supreme Court reversed a 2015 non-discrimination ordinance in Fayetteville that would have granted protections to LGBTQ individuals by banning discrimination based on sexuality or gender identity. The court ruled that the ordinance was unenforceable after state legislators passed a law that doesn't allow cities to extend protections not already afforded by state law, which doesn't include sexual orientation or gender identity as protected classes. City Attorney Kit Williams, who argued on behalf of Fayetteville, says that while it's too late to appeal that decision, the Supreme Court ruling on June 15th is an important step for equality.
So I can tell you, all of us in favor of equality for everybody, we're very overjoyed that the Supreme Court made that decision.
However, Williams says the decision does not explicitly cover all the protections that the city's non-discrimination law had provided.
But we need to remember that this was an interpretation of a federal law involving employment. The other parts of what we did, we were also protecting someone's right to go into an establishment and not be discriminated against because they're just lesbian, gay, or transgender, and also housing. And those two were not part. At least the going into public accommodations, which is like a restaurant or a store or something, was not part of the federal law that the Supreme Court properly interpreted to include protection for lesbian, gays, and transgender. And you should also know that, of course, this was not in a vacuum. There were several circuit courts that had ruled that same way what the Supreme Court, as the Supreme Court did. And we cited those when we were arguing our case before the Supreme Court of Arkansas.
In a conversation with Jewel Hayes, a board member for Northwest Arkansas Equality and a trans civil rights activist, she explains what the decision means for the LGBTQ community in Northwest Arkansas.
I thought it was very positive. I know that in Arkansas that we don't have protections already set up for this. We had tried for an anti-discrimination law in Fayetteville, and the court of Arkansas overturned it, and now we have federal protections, which is really good.
And what do you think this will mean moving forward now that there's a federal law in place or a federal precedent?
It's a good improvement for civil rights of all people, not just trans people or gay people, because if someone wanted to dress a little bit more femininely or masculinely, they wouldn't be discriminated against that, even if they were a straight person. So I think that it helps for all people to be able to be free and love the people that they want to love and dress the way that they want to dress.
And this decision comes just a few days after a federal rule was finalized from the Department of Health and Human Services that gives doctors and insurers basically the right to turn away transgender or LGBTQ people. What does it mean or what does it feel like to have these two things happen simultaneously?
I think that the moment we are in is of growth, and that the people who want civil rights and freedom for all people and everything have been getting more powerful, and we're experiencing some backlash from that. That the conflicts right now show the strength of the civil rights movement that's happening in the United States and all over the world.
And as far as Arkansas, Northwest Arkansas, Fayetteville, how far do we have to go still? What more needs to happen?
I feel like Fayetteville is a liberal island, and what I would like to see is our reach to expand and to help make other places in Arkansas a little bit freer for people to live. And I think we're doing fairly good here, but I think that we need to spread the word and talk to people all throughout our state and try and improve our state in general.
How do you think people can do that?
Well, one of the main things that I think that we can do is that if you have people that you disagree with, instead of blocking them, have a conversation with them. A good leader makes an opportunity to make an ally rather than turning someone into an enemy. So making allies where you can, having conversations with people who disagree with you rather than saying, I hate you and I disagree with your opinion and I don't want to talk to you.
And are there still aspects or places where the rights for LGBTQ people are not being addressed in Arkansas, in Northwest Arkansas? Are there still gaps?
I think that there are some gaps. I know that a lot of women in my community, at least in the trans community, can have a hard time finding a job. Like, just because people worry that we would be bad for business or that some conservative people wouldn't come into work. So on occasion, there is places that will not hire trans people just because they're worried about losing business. And I think that we could improve on that.
And how do you think this Supreme Court case will push that forward?
I think the Supreme Court case will push it forward by letting people who already have their jobs keep their jobs. And it will push forward by letting people know that they're a little bit safer and they can feel a little bit less self-conscious so they can work harder and do better and succeed in their community. If you're worried about losing your job, if you're worried about not having money, then it's hard to grow as a person. So to have protections like this makes us more free to be able to help other people. So Pride is coming up this month on the 26th, and I hope everybody joins us. And over the whole world, virtual Pride is happening. And so it'll be a good opportunity to see what LGBT people look like in every different country, see what rights are like around the world, and help us know where we need to fight our battles.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the deep Arkansas connections to the man in black, Johnny Cash, will be in the spotlight as we hear from the archives of the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy Dixon with the center will be our guide. That's in our second half hour on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks to everybody who has contributed to 91.3 KUAF during our end of the fiscal year fundraiser. You can do so right now if you're able and haven't yet. SupportKUAF.com is the online site where you can do that. When we hit $35,000, the goal for this month, that will actually unlock $19,000, a challenge, a match that has been offered up by generous KUAF donors. And the good news is, the last time I talked with Sherry Ottaviano, KUAF's membership director, we were almost at $32,000 this morning. Almost $32,000. So if you can help us get over that goal, you'll help us end our fiscal year strong and independent. You can make the contribution, if you're able, in the amount that you choose at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
Georgia was one of the first states to reopen, but unlike Texas and Florida, the state is not seeing a surge in coronavirus cases reported. Some scientists believe testing problems might be hiding the true story.
The challenge with Georgia is that the data has been so inconsistent and lumpy.
The story behind the numbers on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition tomorrow from 5 to 9 on 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large. Friday, Tyson Foods released the results of its facility-wide COVID-19 testing in Northwest Arkansas. And on Saturday, activists held another protest demanding the closure of the region's poultry plants. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek has more about both.
So we have wipes, we have masks, if you need any masks. And please be respectful of social distancing, it's very important.
That's Magali Licoli instructing a group of protesters this past Saturday as they were getting ready to march through downtown Springdale, which is home to Tyson Foods headquarters.
What do I want? Workers' rights!
Now!
Licoli is the director and lead organizer at Venceremos, a social justice group focused on the rights of poultry workers.
We want to demand that the governor, Asa Hutchinson, order the shutdown of the poultry plants, which obviously are causing the increase of numbers of COVID-19 in our community. Right now, this is a public concern, as we've been saying since March.
The group marched down Emma Avenue to the Tyson Technology Center, carrying two massive papier-mâché puppets. One was made to look like Governor Asa Hutchinson. The other was meant to represent all the poultry workers in the region. Licoli says those workers have been deemed essential, but they are also being treated as expendable.
So in order to contain the virus in our communities, we need to shut down the poultry plants, to deep sanitizing, and also to put workers in paid quarantine to make sure that workers are not risking their health and life anymore.
Tyson is not the only company with poultry plants in Northwest Arkansas. There's also George's, Cargill, Simmons Foods, and Butterball. But so far, it's the only company that has tested the entirety of its workforce in the region. Results released Friday showed that of its 3,748 employees across 10 facilities, 481, or 13%, tested positive. Of those, nearly 95% were asymptomatic. That's in addition to 212 positive cases identified by the Department of Health or other healthcare providers. Licoli says she's not surprised by those findings and believes those numbers will keep climbing without an intervention from the governor.
I think that he really needs to stand out for the people that he represents. He needs to act accordingly to protect the citizens that he represents. It's the moment for him to stop protecting corporations. This is a pandemic. This is a human crisis, and right now he needs to stand for what is right.
During his coronavirus response briefing last Thursday, Governor Hutchinson was asked about shutting down the plants as more workers become infected, despite protective measures like temperature checks, PPE, and workstation dividers.
No, I don't think that's the solution, to shut down a plant because they have a positive case. They are critical. They're essential industries. They're part of our food supply. Nobody wants to go into a store and not have protein. So that's important. The health of the workers is very important, and that's what they're investing in.
Hutchinson said that aside from being at the poultry plants, each worker also goes home and out into the community.
They go home and then they go to a store. They might go somewhere else. They might go to a church gathering. And so they might then come back in and be asymptomatic and they go to work. And so it's not just what happens in the poultry facility, it's what happens in the workers' lives.
In a recorded statement accompanying the results of Tyson's company-wide testing, Senior Vice President of Human Resources, Hector Gonzalez, said they are educating their team members on the risk factors of COVID-19 and the preventative measures they can take to ensure their safety both at work and at home.
We believe that the education and the testing that we are conducting will help us as well as our plant communities, such as here in Northwest Arkansas, learn more about this virus and the measures that can be taken to avoid the spread of this virus.
A report from the Arkansas Department of Health released Friday shows there have been 921 cases of coronavirus across poultry plants in Benton, Washington, and Madison counties. 329 of them are currently active, with Tyson's Berry Street plant reporting 141 of those active cases. The majority of the employees who have tested positive have been Hispanic or Latino. The Marshallese community is also experiencing a surge in positive cases, many of which have resulted in death. Marshallese people account for about 3% of Northwest Arkansas's 520,000 residents, but they've accounted for more than half the region's deaths, according to coroner's office records from Benton and Washington counties. Dr. Jose Romero, the chief medical officer at the Department of Health, says that's why the state invited the CDC to Arkansas when the agency offered its resources to help identify the modes of transmission that might be contributing to the surge in coronavirus cases in both minority communities.
We think that one of the reasons why this is happening is because they're essential workers. We have not yet made a link between the poultry plants and the individuals becoming infected. But we know that many of them are employed in the poultry industry or the food processing industry. So there certainly could be a link.
But Romero says there could be other links too.
These groups, both the Latinos and Marshallese, are very tight-knit communities, tight-knit families. And so there could be significant intra-family spread.
Romero says the virus may also be spreading as workers are carpooling to work.
You know, could it be during a break room? We're not sure. I mean, all those things will need to be looked at, and we'll try to sort it out. But I think it's important to understand that we still have not established that link directly yet.
Mireya Wraith, the founding director of Arkansas United, an organization that advocates for the state's immigrant communities, met with CDC scientists last week and says it would be unfair to limit the scope of the investigation to cultural and community factors.
And the reality is exposures from everything that we have seen thus far are tied to our immigrants being essential workers, right? And the pressure to keep the economy open.
Wraith also believes employers could still be doing more to protect their workers. And she would like to see those employers and the governor make this commitment.
We need to know that employers and even the governor would be willing to consider closing plants if the data prove that would be a way to curb what is going on.
And Magali Licoli of Venceremos says the rest of Northwest Arkansas should be paying attention too.
Anything that happens in these facilities will come back to those communities. And even if they don't want to see it right now as a problem, eventually if they don't act right now, they're going to see it as their problem too, because they cannot avoid that we are all connected and this is going to affect them eventually.
Although she hasn't been invited yet, Licoli says she's hoping the CDC's scientists will meet with her organization while they're in the region for at least another week. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Zuzana Sitek.
And this weekend, we also learned that China's Customs Authority is suspending imports of poultry products from Tyson's Berry Street plant in Springdale. Tyson spokesman Gary Mickelson told Reuters the company was looking into the issue and that Tyson works closely with U.S. authorities to ensure its food is produced in full compliance with government safety requirements. He also notes that the World Health Organization, the CDC, USDA, and U.S. Food and Drug Administration agree there is no evidence to support transmission of COVID-19 associated with food. Reuters reports that China suspended the importation of pork products from a German pork processor that has also seen a coronavirus outbreak among hundreds of its workers. The country started stepping up its oversight of imported foods after a new cluster of COVID-19 cases was linked to a wholesale food market in Beijing over a week ago. And coming up later this week on Ozarks at Large, we'll explore the impact the coronavirus pandemic is having on the local Marshallese community and what community leaders believe needs to be done about that. This is Ozarks at Large. This is a Monday edition of Ozarks at Large.
Hello, I'm Johnny Kay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. All right.
This is Ozarks at Large. That was Johnny Cash. And Mr. Cash is the subject of this week's Prior Center Profile. To help me navigate through the history of Johnny Cash is Randy Dixon, who is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, thanks for coming back.
What a man. This was fun to do. Thanks for having me.
You bet. There is arguably I mean, Arkansas is rife with wonderful entertainers, right? Sister Rosetta Tharp, Glenn Campbell, who we profiled a few weeks ago, Louis Jordan. Johnny Cash, however, is among the biggest.
The man in black.
Let's talk about Johnny Cash. He is from Arkansas. He, of course, is connected to Dyess, Arkansas, right?
Yes, that's where he was. Well, yeah, that's, you know, well, let's let him tell this story about where he was actually born.
I was born between, you know where Kingsland is, between Pine Bluff and Fordyce. Well, I wasn't born right in Kingsland, you know. I was born in the cotton patch in the woods about 4 miles north of Kingsland, Arkansas, on February 26, 1932. My father was an itinerant worker. He was a hard worker. He rode the rails on and hopped the boxcars going looking for work. 1932 was a hard time for everybody in this country. And he always sent the money back home to my mother wherever he'd go, to Mississippi, Arkansas, whatever kind of a job of work he could get, as he called it. And I grew up by the railroad tracks, and maybe that's why I have an affinity for the trains, and I was always looking for my daddy to come back home. When I was very young, we moved up to northeast Arkansas.
Johnny Cash talking about his early life in Arkansas. And you can just...
Sort of Kingsland.
Sort of Kingsland, right.
Yeah.
And that just points out, Randy, that there is... Obviously, he was a real figure, but there is a mythic sort of story that has built up around Johnny Cash.
Well, he was quite a character, quite a man, had quite a storied life, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes. And he starts out as, you know, he's at Sun Records. He's a rockabilly artist. He gains high-profile hit songs, is sort of someone who charts on the rock and roll, the country charts, and also is someone who becomes known for wanting to represent voices of vulnerable populations.
Well, are you talking about prisoners?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, he did, you know, Folsom Prison. He played at San Quentin, and which I think is awesome. KATV, Channel 7, sponsored him to come to Cummins Prison in 1969, and it was a great background. They pulled up just a flatbed trailer, and Johnny Cash and June, his wife, and the Carter family and the Statler brothers all climbed up on this flatbed trailer and played a full show. It was awesome.
Won't be broken by and by, Lord, by and by.
Daddy sing bass.
Mama sing tenor.
Daddy and little brother join right and back.
You can't talk about Arkansas prisons at that time without talking about, you know, the abuse and the horrible conditions. And for a popular entertainer to go to a prison, that was not normal operating procedure for most musicians or entertainers.
No, and he actually met with Winthrop Rockefeller, the governor, and brought him there, and had, you know, all the people from the prison there. And he talked about issues. He did that at several prisons around the country.
Daddy will sing bass.
Mama sing tenor.
And little brother will join right in there.
In the sky, Lord, in the sky. In the sky, Lord, in the sky.
Was obviously after, you know, Sun Records, and he gains fame. He lived in Tennessee and everything like that. He was not, though, a stranger to coming back to his native state, was he?
Well, this was a really cool thing. In 1976, the bicentennial, he came back to visit Kingsland, his hometown, sort of. And a guy named Geraldo Rivera, who was a reporter for Good Morning America, got on a train with he and June and did a huge report, and it was really cool.
How does it feel coming home? That's, they say you can never come home, but here you are, you're coming home, and the people responded so enthusiastically and with so much love. How does it feel?
Feels good. Really feels good. I wish I could stay more than just a few minutes, though. I had just about 5 minutes to walk down that country road past where my house was, where I was born. I had to get back on the bus and come get on the train, but I've seen all the people I knew. You know, they were all around there. It's always good to see the old faces. And it's something how all the places seem so much smaller when you go back. You know, like you go back to your old home place, everything seems so much smaller.
Did you ever think when your daddy was working that little farm that you had, and you were just really on the, just really on the down and out, that you would become who you became and then be able to come back and give the people so much joy by coming back home?
You know, I always knew, Geraldo, that I was going to do what I'm doing. Somehow, some way, I always knew it. I never thought about things like this, you know, all the tributes and honors and so forth, but I always knew I would be an entertainer. I knew that this is what my life is meant to be.
You also have some cuts from sort of a banquet or a salute.
Yeah. All right. So back in the early 80s, KATV Channel 7 used to do these toast and roast, celebrity toast and roast events. It's a black tie event, and it would raise money for Big Brothers Big Sisters. And they would get different people. They had Glenn Campbell. They had other folks, but they got Johnny Cash to come and be the roasted person. And his wife came, and this is kind of what she had to say. And I mean, it wasn't necessarily a roast. She was very candid about the problems that Johnny had had.
Johnny Cash, he's known for a lot of things. First of all, when you think of Johnny Cash, you think of drugs, because they wrote all kinds of books. Every magazine in the country told all about how he went through with all the drug bit and all. He took them all, everything except some of the new things that's come along that the kids probably know more, a whole lot more about than he does. But he did his share of all of that back then. You think about trains, and you think about black, and you think about prisons. Well, that's Johnny Cash. You think of all of those things.
That's June Carter talking about Johnny Cash. You say this was the early 80s?
Yes. Yeah, it's about 82.
Okay.
And, yeah, she was talking about his, you know, drug addiction and his problems. But you know who else was there?
Tell me.
Minnie Pearl. Remember Minnie Pearl?
I remember Minnie Pearl. For those who don't, she was a comedian who played to generally a country music sort of friendly audience.
Well, she had the hat with the tag
right.
still on it, right?
Yeah. Right.
But she was a huge star at the time, and she came in to Little Rock to pay a tribute to Johnny Cash. And, she talked about his time at the Grand Ole Opry, his first time at the Grand Ole Opry, which, you know, that's huge.
I was in the dressing room off to the side of the historic old Ryman Auditorium one night, and I had heard that the guest that night was a young man named Johnny Cash. And I had been on the road. I stayed on the road for 27 years on one-night stands, and I had to live to be as old as I am before I realized the young people have another meaning for that. But what I was going to say was that I was sitting in that dressing room, and this young, handsome man, oh, he was still is. But he was young and virile, and he was a beautiful man. Oh, and had this magnificent voice. And he was scared. He said he was scared. People are scared when they come on the opera for the first time. It's a prestigious show. It's an old show. We will pass our 58th birthday, our anniversary, this October, and I will pass my 43rd year there at the same time. And it's a... Johnny came in and sat down by me, and we were sort of going over the show. And I thought then that I knew that he was headed for real great things. And he has had them, and he will have them, and he is having them. But I'm glad to be here tonight and say howdy to all you good Arkansas people. And it's a wonderful occasion to have people, your people, accept you and tell you how much they love you. It's a very beautiful thing. And I wasn't born here, but if it ever happens again, I'm going to see to it. It happens right here. Good man, John. You are great.
Minnie Pearl at a toast and roast of Johnny
Can
Cash.
You tell?
Oh,
she
yes.
Kinda liked
oh,
me.
Yes.
Yeah.
you know, we heard June Carter talking pretty honestly about Johnny Cash's substance abuse and challenges. I actually saw him talk about those challenges in the late 80s in Fayetteville.
Yes. Tell me about that.
Well, so this was the 1 year that I worked at Kix 104 radio station. And in the summer at that point, Fayetteville hosted for a few years, at least in a row, something, I won't remember the right title, but it was the Drug and Education Conference. So people who dealt with rehab or drug and alcohol abuse education would meet in Fayetteville at what was then called the Hilton. Other years they had had, and they would always have sort of a keynote speaker. 1 year it was B.J. Thomas, remember him? The guy who sang Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. 1 year it was Suzanne Summers, the actress who had been in Three's Company. Well, I think it's 1988, it was Johnny Cash. As the news director at Kix 104, I was able to go in and watch this performance. It was in front of the educators and the counselors. And
wow.
I'll tell you, Randy, so here's the thing. I was allowed to record 5 minutes, right? Because I needed to go back and have some tape for the afternoon newscasts that day. Mm-hmm. And so they said, you could tape 5 minutes. I think it might have even been, you can get the first 5 minutes. And after that, you can't do it. Well, here's the thing, Randy. I forgot to turn off my tape recorder. It was a cassette recorder. And I looked down at the end of this, and I had recorded most of it. And I think, and this says a lot about who I am, I think I went back to Kix 104, used a few seconds of it for the newscast, and then probably destroyed it because I thought I'd get thrown in the slammer or something.
Well, see, KATV, Tim Hamilton, who was our photographer, came in, and he thought the same thing.
Really?
And he started to roll, and before he knew it, it was over. And I had the full hour that I just
He did the same thing?
Yesterday, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
We got the whole thing. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I found a clip of him, you know, talking about his, you know, addiction. And, you know, the thing is, he really did own it.
I was telling Reba, it's been so long since I've been back to Arkansas, and I'm so happy that I could come for this kind of a thing and call it a homecoming, because today you're going to see the heart and soul, hopefully, of a real drug addict and alcoholic who, gratefully, by the grace of God, is recovering. But you're going to hear it from me. Anything you want to hear out of me, you're going to get it. I'm going to talk a while, may sing a little bit. I don't know, I never did, but I'm going to try. But then I'm going to answer some questions. If you got anything, I always raise more questions than I answer when I'm talking, because I have had such a wonderful, long, strange, unusual, blessed life that... I have to stop and think, well, you know, they don't know what I'm talking about.
I am so happy this is preserved, because I have been kicking myself for, you know, 32 years that I didn't keep this cassette tape.
I had planned the whole time to end this segment with a song called Hurt by Nine Inch Nails that he did on his last album that Rick Rubin got him to do. But, you know, I was watching this performance of his in Fayetteville, and he picks up his guitar and he said, you know, he's alone on the stage with an acoustic guitar, and it's a rehab show. And he said, people ask me about why I'm called the Man in Black. And man, I had to do this song. This is the one to close with.
All right. Well, we will close with it. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. So many things are being digitized. Just Google Pryor Center. Randy, if you'll have us, we'll let you come back and do another one.
Hey, if you'll have me, I'll be here.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back. You wonder why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone. Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear the black for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the times. I wear the black for the sick and the lonely old.
This is Ozarks at Large.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support provided by Butterfield Trail Village, a premier Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being, offering a variety of amenities including apartments, cottages, and village homes living options. Information at butterfieldtrailvillage.org.
Right now, it's difficult to keep up with everything that's going on, so we keep you up to date each weekday morning with newscasts about where we live. Antoinette Grajeda delivers the news of our region each Monday through Friday morning at 5:30 and 7:30. And Pete Hartman keeps us up to date on local nonprofit work during this pandemic with the Community Spotlight each morning at 6:30 and 8:30 on 91.3 KUAF.
Hi, I'm John Lansing, NPR's CEO. We work with hundreds of local stations across the U.S., including this one, to bring you the most impartial, honest, and trustworthy news we can. It doesn't start with me or at NPR or even at this station. It all begins with one person, you. Be a pillar of support for this station. Please donate today.
Big thank you to everyone who makes Public Radio 91.3 KUAF, Ozarks at Large, all possible through your support. If you're able, you can pick an amount that is comfortable for you and go to supportkuaf.com. And a big thanks from all of us that work on Ozarks at Large, work at 91.3 KUAF, and from your fellow listeners who use KUAF just like you do. Thank you very much. SupportKUAF.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Among the hundreds of protesters who showed up in Tulsa this weekend to voice opposition to the president's 2020 campaign rally were a couple from Fayetteville. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with them late yesterday about their experience.
Renaga Farbiage and his partner Ludi Bausman joined several hundred civil rights protesters outside the Bank of Oklahoma Center Arena late Saturday evening as Trump rally participants were leaving.
All right, so now they're getting louder. We might have to back away a little bit just to give them their space.
News video as well as Facebook recordings, which Ludi Bausman took, shows agitated Trump supporters screaming at African-American protesters. The National Guard quickly intervened, Bausman says, quelling confrontations. Farbiage and Bausman agreed to talk Sunday afternoon, wearing masks inside their downtown Fayetteville shop, American Shaman Kava Bar.
What we saw were thousands of people coming out of the center from the rally. They were very identifiable. They had, you know, their support Trump signs. They had red, white, and blue clothing and attire. They seemed peaceful did not see any major conflict between the people that were there supporting Black Lives Matter and those anti-Trump people. There was not any conflict that we were a witness to. We did see one situation. It was a group of young people. They were young Trump supporters and young Black Lives Matter protesters and allies to Black Lives Matter. And they got into kind of a heated conversation, obviously, about how they felt about the situation.
Given the negative press leading up to the Trump campaign rally, the couple almost decided against going, Bausman says.
And I am so, so thankful that we did. We had many people come up to us and thank us for being there, thank us for being their allies. It was amazing. It was just completely amazing.
The Trump campaign advertised an overflow crowd, saying millions of supporters had signed up, but the Tulsa Fire Department estimates around 6,200 attended the rally. In response, the campaign claimed radical protesters had blocked access to the rally, causing a massive decline in attendance. News photos reveal the National Guard kept arena entrances and street access clear. After Trump left and supporters departed, protesters regathered a mile away in the historic Greenwood District, where a celebration was taking place. A century ago, a white mob destroyed this African-American neighborhood, where as many as 300 Black residents were killed, leaving the prosperous Greenwood District, once referred to as America's Black Wall Street, in ruins. Memorials have been held, but no reparations have occurred. Runaga Farbiash, the son of a Holocaust survivor, understands firsthand the devastating impact of cultural oppression. He says the Greenwood District celebration Saturday evening was emotionally overwhelming.
White, Black, Latino, Asian, it was just a beautiful celebration of equality, justice, solidarity. It was fantastic. It was the most moving thing that I'd been a part of since I was at the 1964 Democratic National Convention and I sat with the Mississippi Freedom Delegation. All of the speeches that were made by the organizers were about peace, equality, justice, thanking people for being there to support. And it was a celebration. It was fantastic. It was awe-inspiring.
Leading up to Trump's Saturday campaign rally, the president tweeted that, quote, protesters, anarchists, agitators, looters, and lowlifes could expect rough law enforcement treatment. A Tulsa police Twitter feed Saturday night, however, reported, quote, multiple groups of demonstrators with varying viewpoints in the area adjacent to the rally were overwhelmingly peaceful. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And this is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Yell County. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to tonight's show included Daniel Carruth, Zuzanna Sitek, and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Our thanks to Randy Dixon with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Daniel Carruth, by the way, produces his stories inside the Karen Taha News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. We'll have a brand new show for you tomorrow at noon. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday night with us. Be well.